This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's joinmidi.com.
That's the number to call if you want to get involved. Call me, text me anytime. Joining us on the line right now, on very short notice, I might add, is Victoria Elliott, the Platforms and Power Reporter at Wired Magazine. Victoria, welcome to the show. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. All right. Reading now from this article you published just this morning, Meta has announced that it would ban RT, Russia Today, and other media outlets backed by the Russian state from its platform. YouTube has removed more than 230 channels with connections to Russian-backed media. Those decisions follow the State Department's imposition of sanctions on Russian state media, saying that in addition to spreading disinformation about the war in Ukraine, RT is supporting a crowdfunding effort to support the military's invasion, and they had developed operation directly tied to Russia's intelligence agencies. Victoria, it didn't always used to be this way, did it? Where you couldn't really tell where the distinction was between Russian state media and Russian intelligence.
Well, I think the thing is that, you know, when we're talking about propaganda efforts, there's a long history of that. I think the bigger issue is that, particularly in the online space, you have Russia Today and Russian outlets have been very good at sort of cloaking their origin. So, for instance, they had a short form video platform for a while called Ruptly, and that didn't overtly say, like, this is the social media video outlet for RT. You kind of had to dig to figure that out. And so there's ways in which they've really obfuscated where these things are originating. Sometimes they'll have partnerships with local publications, particularly in places like Africa and Latin America, where they are an incredibly popular news source to sort of disseminate stories. And then on top of that, you have sort of what we see with a lot of Russian propaganda and disinformation campaigns, where they may actually back a local news organization, help fund them, or, you know, feed them stories. And so we have these layers of the way propaganda can sort of disseminate. And social media has been a really big part of that. And just like we're all sort of struggling to figure out what's real online, they really kind of take advantage of the fact that, you know, we are not always being the most critical thinkers when we're consuming things online. And there's a lot of easy ways to obfuscate something's origins in those spaces.
It makes me think also about Epoch Times, which, you know, it sounds kind of innocuous. You know, it's usually got cat videos and, you know, people skydiving and things like that. But then occasionally there's a political story. They'll support some sort of angle and people will share that. And they have no idea that Epoch Times was founded by a, like, Chinese separatist religious cult, the Falun Gong. There's just complete opacity in terms of who owns some of these accounts and channels that are disseminating not just political content, but all kinds of content on all these platforms. What a mess. Great. I'm glad you mentioned Latin America and Africa. Let's start there. So what does RT's presence in this region mean for the United States and our interests? What are they doing there? What are they telling their audiences?
Totally. So, you know, I think we have to contextualize this in that, like, Latin America and Africa have been real victims of Western imperialism. A lot of, like, the poverty and corruption that makes them difficult places sometimes are the result of the policies of Europe and the U.S.
Absolutely.
And so that means that, like, an entity like RT coming in and being like, hey, the U.S. is bad for you, or, hey, like, they're trying to mess with you, or they're trying to take your stuff, or they're saying this about the war in Ukraine, but that's not true. It's U.S. imperialism. There's been a big push, particularly in the past 2 years, in the Latin American and African media ecosystems by Russia to really reframe the war in Ukraine as sort of Russia resisting U.S. imperialism. And that is a narrative that feels very resonant to people in those places, because that is pretty resonant with their experiences of us in a foreign policy capacity in some ways. So I think really they're sort of hooking into that space in these countries. And also, I think it's really important to note that, like, they've really invested in sort of like the local language and local politics of these places, particularly in Latin America. And so, you know, they have offices in Havana and Buenos Aires. They have journalists who speak the language fluently. And, you know, we have Voice of America. We have similar sort of state-backed news outlets. Mm-hmm. But I think the difference for us is that, at least as far as I know, and who knows what I don't know, you know, Voice of America, based on the 1994 Broadcast Act, it's supposed to be firewalled from other U.S. agencies and from U.S. government meddling in their content. Whereas, you know, Russia, that's not necessarily the case. There is much more of a opacity between the state agencies and propaganda and the actual news outlet. But that's not always evident to someone who's a consumer in Latin America, who feels like here's an international news outlet that has this sort of anti-imperialist take, and that in some cases, as you mentioned with the Epoch Times, is sharing factual or completely unharmful content.
Mm-hmm. So what effect are those investments having in this region? Are there, you know, elections or political movements happening in Latin America and Africa that are turning and operating, you know, based in large or small part on this Russian propaganda?
Yeah, I mean, I think a big place that you can see this is, you know, in places like the Central African Republic, which have also been places where, you know, you have groups like the Wagner Group that's been very present there. And, you know, you see in places like those areas where there's a lot of, you know, historical and well-founded resentment against, in this case, the French and UN agencies. Mm-hmm. And it's also a mineral-rich country. And I've seen personally a lot of Russian propaganda really targeting people there around building on resentment to the French, building on resentment to the UN, really framing Russia as this sort of ally to the country. And that's all serving the interests of making sure that the Wagner Group has access to the really important mining resources in the Central African Republic. And so I think, you know, that is not necessarily RT, although RT does have a pretty robust French service. That's also even smaller publications or even Facebook groups. So I think, and that's a really great example of these types of things. I think, you know, we're also, you know, looking at people like Argentina's new president, who was elected last year, Milei, who, although he has sort of said supportive things about Ukraine, you know, he has the sort of politics of being a bit more libertarian, right-leaning, that really jives with some of the way that, you know, Russian interests work on the continent. So I think we see this play out differently in different places, but I do think that it's important to think about, you know, the ways in which, particularly in places like the Central African Republic or poor communities, there's not a hugely robust media ecosystem in these places.
Right.
And so that means that there's a lot of room for maneuvering in a way that there might not be in other countries.
Do you see other efforts from other nations, you know, the sort of ones that we talk about in Western media all the time as being the ones that are, you know, working against us? I'm chiefly talking about Iran and China, I guess. Are they having a similar influence in these regions, or is Russia kind of standing alone in this regard?
I think Russia's been pretty aggressive, but particularly when we're talking about China, you know, there are definitely information operations, but a lot of the way China works is much more sort of economic Belt and Road initiative. And, you know, I spent a couple of years when I was in my 20s living in Accra and then in Nairobi, and there are Chinese infrastructure projects all over these places. And that's a very key component of how China sort of builds goodwill in these regions. In Nairobi, when I lived there, there was one hot pot restaurant. Now there's like a burgeoning Chinatown. And that is, because Chinese workers are coming there to help build these infrastructure projects. So I think in the ways that we're thinking about diplomacy more broadly, outside of sort of tech and platforms and information operations, that is a really big one. And that doesn't mean China doesn't run influence operations, because they definitely do, particularly targeted at places like the Philippines and Vietnam, where they sort of have these territorial disputes over the South China Sea. That's definitely true. But I think if we're talking about how they're really marshaling their interests, you know, Russia is not necessarily building roads. It definitely is king of the information space in some of these places. But if we're talking about, you know, building entrenched ties into some of these markets, I think the Chinese economic moves are really, really important to contextualize.
That is so interesting. Yeah. Why build a seaport when you could just launch a TV network in a country where they have, you know, one, two TV networks, you know, and suddenly you can become much more influential in that way, instead of just getting the country to sort of trust you and be economically tied to you. You don't need to be their friends necessarily if you're covertly operating, you know, as a major player in their media ecosystem, and you can just kind of wind them up and point them at whatever your target is that week. That's some pretty pernicious stuff. Victoria, I wonder if I can keep you around about another 10 minutes. I want to take a break, and then I'm going to come back and ask you about more what's happening in the U.S. now that we've covered what's happening abroad. Sound okay?
Sure.
Okay, great. We'll step away. My guest is Victoria Elliott. Victoria is the Platforms and Power Reporter at Wired Magazine. The number to call if you want to ask a question or shoot me a text, 504-260-1870. I will have Victoria probably another 10 minutes here. So, you know, get in touch. Ian Hoken for Scoot on WWL.
This show is sponsored by Midi Health. There are great things that come with age: wisdom, experience, and knowledge, just to name a few. But if you're a woman over 40, it can also bring some less desirable things like hot flashes, insomnia, brain fog, moodiness, and weight gain, all symptoms of menopause and perimenopause. Yes, hormonal transition is a fact of life, but that doesn't mean you have to accept its symptoms as just another part of aging. Midi clinicians are menopause experts, equipped to support you with safe, effective, FDA-approved medications, as well as supplements, lifestyle coaching, and preventative health guidance. You'll come out of the experience feeling heard and with a plan to start feeling better. Midi offers accessible care. All their services are covered by insurance, and they're conveniently accessible through telehealth visits and 24/7 messaging. You deserve to feel great. Book your virtual visit today at joinmidi.com. That's join, MIDI.com.
Be right back. 142 here on WWL AM, FM, WWL.com, and always live on the free Odyssey app. My guest this hour is Victoria Elliott, the Platforms and Power Reporter at Wired Magazine. Victoria, thanks for sticking around. I want to bring the conversation back to the U.S. In the last segment, we really kind of did a high dive on what Russian intelligence via Russian state media is doing in developing countries around the world, places that have historically had maybe a contentious relationship with the U.S. and European nations. Let's bring it home. I want to talk to you about what the practical effect is of Meta and YouTube banning these state media outlets. If folks don't know, Meta is, of course, the parent company of Facebook and Instagram. So between Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube, Russian media, Russia Today, has sort of lost a big tool in its toolkit in terms of reaching Western audiences. Victoria, how much of an impact do you think that's really going to have on reducing the spread of Russian disinformation?
Well, I do think it's definitely a blow, because Meta in particular was a really fruitful avenue for RT and for other propaganda efforts. Experts I spoke to said that the accounts for RT, I think, had about 7 million followers on Meta's platform. So, like, it was a pretty impactful channel for them. Similarly, YouTube, the accounts that were removed because YouTube actually began restricting RT after the invasion of Ukraine. But there were a bunch of other channels like this one, African Streams, which, again, does not necessarily say that it is run by RT or by the Russian government, but, you know, was identified as such by the State Department. So YouTube removed about 230 different channels. We don't know all of them that were a part of this. So, I mean, I think it is a really big deal because obviously these platforms are global, right? So even if RT was not super interesting to an American user, like, the reality is that it might still be very interesting to a African, Southeast Asian, Latin American Facebook or Instagram user. So it is a big blow. But I also think, like, that one of the experts that I spoke to sort of mentioned the fact that, like, you know, RT has sort of been setting up this narrative for a while that, like, they might get censored, that, you know, the U.S. doesn't want you to know the truth sort of thing. So the idea that they might be pulled off these platforms, and while it might damage their reach, could also kind of boost their credibility. Like, yeah, the big bad U.S. and the big bad U.S. tech companies are coming for this truth-telling organization. So I think there's always a way to spin it. And that doesn't mean we're not going to see disinformation and information operations run by Russia as well. They just may not necessarily be packaged with RT.
Yeah, there's always that kind of backfiring effect, right? Where if you say, well, we're gonna ban you because you're breaking the law or you're breaking the terms of service, then they just go somewhere else and they say, oh, well, now we're being oppressed. Now we're the victims here. And I'm thinking about how, you know, if you kick everybody off YouTube and Facebook and Instagram, they're just going to end up on Rumble and Twitter and, you know, whatever else. It'll always be Twitter on this program. And those places have much less restrictive content policies, but they still have big audiences. So it's kind of playing whack-a-mole here.
Totally. And, you know, I thought it was very funny that the day after the ban happened, RT on X, formerly Twitter, posted this tweet saying, here are our accounts on all these other platforms. It was VK, which is sort of the Russian version of YouTube, Rumble, as you mentioned, Gab, and obviously on X. And, you know, what they said is, you know, Meta can ban us all they want, but you can always find us here. And I think this is such a particular thing because a lot of times these companies don't coordinate with each other, right? And so it means that Meta could have perfect enforcement around anything, hate speech, disinformation, propaganda, etc. But if it's still spreading on other platforms, A, it will almost always find its way back. But B, you know, there's only so much one company can do. So I agree. It's definitely like playing whack-a-mole, especially because all these platforms sort of have different policies in general. And on top of that, they're not necessarily communicating with each other.
Yes. And some of them have erratic, mercurial, narcissist sociopaths that own them and kind of say I'm a free speech absolutist. So bring in your lies, bring in your Russian propaganda, more neo-Nazis. And that's why that website is the way it is today. So you've highlighted in your article that Russian media will cede stories to smaller publications, right? And then also make use of local digital influencers. Let's go back, and it's been a couple weeks, and I just kind of want to get, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, the way that we talk about Tenet Media and what happened with Tim Pool and Benny Johnson and some of these other people that were on the direct payroll of these Russian individuals that are now indicted by the Department of Justice. Is that do you think that's the end of that story, or is it possible that there are other influencers, podcasters, media personalities out there that are still carrying water for Russian intelligence, and either their audience is unaware or the U.S. government is unaware? How big is that threat? Or do you think Tenet Media and that saga was kind of the alpha and omega of that effort?
Wow. You've actually hit on something that I have spent a lot of time thinking about. I can talk about some of it now and some of it we'll be reporting later. But my answer is that, first off, with the Tenet Media thing, I think in the indictment it said there were hundreds of influencers on the payroll. but a lot of them don't know they're working for Russian campaigns, right? Mm-hmm. They just know that, like, they're being given information with a certain angle, maybe to boost or to reshare or whatever. And I think, first off, like, the influencer space is the next frontier of information operations, and that's because it is so much more opaque. You know, it's easier to hide money if you're paying into a shell company who pays another shell company who pays a marketing agency who pays the influencers on their payroll. It's so much easier to hide these things that way. It's also more difficult to show that stuff is networked. You know, there's all these other ways of obfuscating things that I think we are just 100% not ready for yet. But I do think that, like, you know, with Tenet, you had maybe a couple of people who kind of knew what was up. But even then, they were dealing with, you know, most people thought they were dealing with this capricious European billionaire who wanted to back some YouTube channels and a media outlet. They didn't think they were dealing with a Russian-backed influence campaign. And I think that is actually probably going to be really common, where influencers or media professionals think that they are dealing with one entity and sharing content with a certain sort of political view on behalf of one entity, but it's actually an influence operation. Similarly, I think, you know, we see this a lot even with, like, in the health space. You know, there's a lot of vaccine skepticism. I recently wrote a piece on astrology online and how it's very popular. And it's very easy to go from, like, reading your daily horoscope into a sort of QAnon rabbit hole. The algorithm sort of funnels you that way. And so you, as an influencer who might like charging your crystals and care about when the full moon is, might end up in the orbit of another influencer who's spreading anti-vaccine content, and they could also be a propaganda, like an influence account, and you might be liking their stuff, which boosts them up in the algorithm because that's how these platforms work. You know, I think there's a lot of ways in which there's a lot of unwitting participation in these things, whether it's people resharing content that it turns out is part of these networks, or influencers who think that they're working for one person and they're working for someone totally different. You know, I think that's what makes them so hard to track.
Man. Yeah. If the DOJ doesn't get involved, then there's no accountability for any of these people. I think that, you know, an enterprising reporter like yourself or somebody else could have blown this story up and said, holy cow, Tim Pool, this really pretty influential person online who's got, you know, millions and millions of views and millions of subscribers, is taking $100,000 per episode from Russian state media. That seems to me, and I'm sad about this, this is really unfortunate, that seems to me like the kind of story that's going to wash out of the news cycle in like 36 hours. And next week, Tim Pool's still going to be back with a new episode. So I wonder if do you agree or disagree with that? First of all, let me just put it to you that way.
You know, I think the way the news cycle moves is incredibly fast. And, you know, that is the product of our modern internet. I think that, like, unfortunately, all this stuff, like, I mean, if I just go back and think about, like, all the big things that I have reported on in the past, like, couple of years, I'm like, wow, I can't believe I fit all that in my brain. You know, I think we're all a bit overwhelmed. And I also think, you know, maybe the public's detriment, the media can often treat each of these stories like a distinct thing. You know what I mean? Like, oh, this Tenet media thing, and then this RT thing, and then also maybe this other thing and this other thing. And I don't know that we always do a great job of mapping out the scale of the problem. And also, like, we're trying to be empathetic to our audiences, right? Like, maybe our audience would not want to, like, read hundreds of thousands of words mapping all of this out, doing the, like, you know, the thing like Charlie from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia with the board, you know, like
the red
maybe
string.
Our audience, maybe that's not helpful to our audience. But I think, you know, as a reporter, I know there's so much like information and connections that I just sort of keep in my head because I cover these things that most normal Americans are not really keying into, and that's okay. That's like, it's not the job of every U.S. citizen to have a murder board in their mind to like wonder if the thing that they're interacting with on Instagram after a long day at work is an influence campaign. you know, but I do think that, you know, but that's a real challenge for us as a media industry, and a real challenge, obviously, for the government. And I don't, you know, I don't have a solution. We are not in a position to tell capitalism and the platforms behind it to slow down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that would be an effective use of our time anyway. We better stop here, Victoria. But boy, I've really enjoyed talking to you. This was a great conversation. You made yourself available on extremely short notice. Thank you so much for your time, your work. It's so important. Thank you for your work. And thank you for your way. Have a great week. We'll keep in touch. OK.
Thanks so much.
All right. Victoria Elliott is the platforms and power reporter at Wired Magazine. You can go read her work at Wired.com. Thanks again, Victoria. I'm Ian Hoke, sitting in for Scoot right here on WWL, AMFM.com and the Odyssey app. I got time for a couple of your reactions before we hit the news at 2 o'clock. Shoot me a call. Shoot me a text. 504-260-1870. BRB.